You are listening to End of Life University Podcast, real talk about life and death. This is episode number 190. Welcome to End of Life University Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, hospice physician, author, and educator. In this podcast, I share thoughtful conversations with experts in various fields related to dying and death, and informative teaching sessions on preparing for the end of life by living fully today. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. I'm glad you're here with me today. I'll be sharing an interview with you a little bit later on with Lucinda Herring, and we'll be talking about reimagining death. And Lucinda shares a lot of her personal experiences and wisdom about home funeral vigils and green burial, and I think you'll really love this conversation. So stay tuned, and that'll be coming up in a few minutes. And first, I have just a few announcements once again to remind you. I will be co-teaching a course this summer starting July 9th with the Reverend Dr. Terry Daniel on spiritual journeys in chronic illness. And this will be an online course, 8 weeks long with 16 sessions. So there are two sessions per week. CEUs are available for this course, and it's being offered through the Applied Wisdom Institute and Redlands University. It'll be a fantastic course, so if you're interested in getting some credits, we'll be talking a lot about rituals and practices that can be used in the care of patients with chronic illness, but we're going to cover all sorts of topics during this course. You can go to a web page. Here's the shortened link, bit.ly/chronic-illness-course, and read all about it, and you can also register for the course there. And there will also be a link to sign up for the registration page in the show notes for this podcast at eolupodcast.com. And again, this is episode number 190. So if you're interested, check out that course, Spiritual Journeys in Chronic Illness. And I will also let you know about the beautiful Dying Expo, which is a huge expo on end of life issues coming up November 2nd and 3rd in San Diego. And opportunities are available right now to sign up to be a vendor and have a booth or a table in the hall. You can also sign up or apply to be a workshop presenter, to do a book signing, or to screen a film during this event. And I will be there as a facilitator. So again, it's the beautiful Dying Expo in San Diego, November 2nd and 3rd. It's going to be a fantastic event. And I think the whole end-of-life community has been waiting for a long time for something like this to happen, a huge conference that lets all of us come together from many different disciplines and just spend a couple of days learning from each other and networking. So it's going to be fantastic. And you can go to the website beautifuldyingexpo.com to check out more about that, and I will also post that link on the show notes at eolupodcast.com. So today I have two new patrons to thank who have stepped up to offer their support each month, Sarah Tinez and Rachel Geiger. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining the team and becoming new patrons on my page at patreon.com/EOLU. And thanks as well to everyone who's been supporting the podcast for the last couple of years. It means everything to me, on the one hand, to have your financial support, but also just knowing that you're out there listening and that you appreciate what I'm doing and are willing to contribute to it means everything to me emotionally and spiritually. And so I love hearing from you. I love finding out that you enjoy the content that I'm putting out into the world. Keeps me going week after week. Because again, as I've mentioned a few times, I'm usually recording these episodes sitting all by myself in a room somewhere and then posting it online without really even knowing how many people are listening or if it's making a difference. And so your contributions on Patreon let me know that you care about what I'm doing, and also the emails and messages that you send me through Twitter and Instagram are greatly, greatly appreciated. So thanks all of you out there. If you're interested in joining our Patreon team, you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/EOLU, and you'll be able to see the different tier levels of support that you can sign up for and become part of our community. So thanks again for considering that. Now we'll move on with my interview with Lucinda Herring. And as always, please stay tuned to after the end of this interview, because I'll be coming back on. Lucinda has sent me a few other comments that we didn't have time for during our interview, but a few things that she was just hoping that I could add on at the end. So keep listening all the way through to the end, and you'll be able to hear Lucinda's extra comments that she wanted to make. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Here we go. Today, I'm very excited to be welcoming my guest, Lucinda Herring. And I'll tell you a little bit about Lucinda before we get started with our conversation. She has worked at the cutting edge of the green funeral movement for more than 20 years. And today, she's one of the leading voices for more healing and ecological ways to care for our dead. She's a home funeral green disposition consultant and guide, an interfaith minister, and a licensed funeral director in the state of Washington. Lucinda is also the author of the recently released book, Reimagining Death: Stories and Practical Wisdom for Home Funerals and Green Burials. So, Lucinda, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen. I'm so grateful to be here.
Well, I've been following you for a long time through Facebook. I think I've been reading your posts and following what you've been doing, and then I read your book, and so it's funny, I feel like I know you really well, but this is actually the first time we've been able to have a conversation together, so I'm really excited about it.
Thank you. I feel the same way. I feel like if I know you too, we're in the same movement, and that creates a bond, I believe.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, Lucinda, about your story. I really love hearing from all of my guests about how they got started initially doing the work they're doing. So would you tell us that? How did you first get interested in green burial and home funerals?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, I'm, as an interfaith minister, I've always been someone whom people come to at times of change, at threshold times of transition and change. And I've worked with families and children and festival making around the seasons of the Earth year for many years with Waldorf families and community here on my island and in the city of Seattle nearby. So I've always been involved in community building through threshold times and how we can gather as families and communities to help each other and support each other and to have fun together and to honor and support, you know, difficult times in people's lives. So I was already doing that work here on the island, my island, Whidbey Island. And one of my friends, Judy Hodges, got breast cancer, and she asked a group of women here to care for her after death. She just didn't want a funeral home to care for her body after death. And this was in 1997, which is early days for anyone to really be aware that we can legally care for our own dead. So we researched it all and realized that we actually could do it, and we educated ourselves, and we took care of Judy after she died for 3 days, and we had just such a transformative experience that we decided as a community to try and do this for each other. And this was, you know, quite early, like I said, in the late 90s. It turns out that this was happening in many places across the country. About the same time, Jerry Grace Lyons, she also had a friend in California who asked her to care for her when she died. And Beth Knox on the East Coast, who has the organization Crossings, her young daughter Allison died, and she decided to try to care for her herself. So it was part of a collective wave of awareness that this was a possible thing to do, to have home funeral vigils and more natural ways of caring for our dead. So I, because of who I was, I believe, and also because I was one who needed an income in my group here on the island, I said that I would go and train to become a home funeral consultant and guide and become certified so that we could continue to do this work in our community. And I trained at the same time with Char Barrett, who later became a licensed funeral director in Washington. She owns a funeral home called A Sacred Moment in Everett. She's still there. And I've worked with her for 7 years. I think at the beginning, as a home funeral guide, I was calling Char so often with questions and backup within the industry to engage with the funeral industry, that when she started her business in Everett, she called and said, Lucinda, you should just come and get your funeral director's license. And I was so grateful for that opportunity because, one, I could work and do my internship in a funeral home that was alternative from the beginning and supported home funerals and green burial. And two, I got to work with Char and other wonderful women and a man, Christopher Ronk. And it was just a wonderful opportunity. I worked there for 7 years and really just stopped working there in order to write my book, which I've been doing for the last 2 years. So I would say that I write in my book that love drew me to this, a great passion to bring death back into life and to bring more natural and more sacred ways of caring for our own at the end of life. And also, it met my deep environmental, my environmentalist self. It met that need as well, because I wanted to work for the earth and for the natural world and the seen and unseen realms at the threshold of death. And that was because when my mother died in 2001 on my land in Alabama, I had a very transformative experience with her death. By working with the land itself and with the natural world in order to help ease her transition and in order to help support me and my family in being able to care for her in more natural and sacred ways. And the question arose in that time in my heart, really, what does it mean to co-create with nature and with the earth at the threshold of death? And that question still lives within me and has deeply informed my work in this field. And it's also kept me saying yes to the work, because I feel so deeply that there really is a co-creation happening between human beings and the natural world in all of our lives, in every moment of our lives. But that if we listen at the threshold of death, we are greatly informed and supported. And so I wanted to write about that. And that's what my book has been
And that's
inspired by.
Such a beautiful thought, Lucinda, that we co-create at the threshold of death with nature, because since
dying itself and death and then decomposition are all natural processes. And it makes sense that it's mankind ourselves. We have removed ourselves from the natural process. We actually have stepped back and we make the natural process more difficult. And I love this idea of just returning to co-create that process with nature and being open to what should happen naturally on its own anyway if we allow it.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, and it's been so helpful to think of it in that way, because you're right that the way we've been doing death in the last 100 years, 150 years is, you know, not co-creating with the way death wants us to. I say that actually in a conscious way. I believe that death can be our ally and an actual presence that we can work with co-creatively as well. So when we co-create with nature, we also are co-creating with death itself, with our own deaths, with the small deaths that happen every day in our lives, with the fact that things are impermanent. Nothing that we've done in our funeral industry, you know, has supported that. And it's not it's not a critique of the industry. It is in a way, because I believe that we have suffered deeply financially and emotionally and spiritually by giving over this capacity in ourselves, this natural capacity to understand our own mortality and to be present to that and to work with it as a natural part of life. And because the way we do it now in our society, when someone dies, you know, we immediately call a funeral home, funeral director, to come and take the body of our loved one away, we're really asking strangers to care for that person, someone whom we've cared for a long, long time, probably maybe sometimes a lifetime. And suddenly we just give all of that care over to strangers in the industry. And that itself is unnatural. That's been my experience, and I think it's the experience of many people. And yet we haven't known that we had the opportunity and even the legal opportunity to reclaim that sacred task as an innate right that we have as human beings.
Yes, and as you point out, it's been the funeral industry, but also the medical industry, my profession, that have played a role in our distancing from the natural process of dying and after death care. But in many ways, I think, as you said, perhaps not to blame those two industries, because they've been part of the evolution of our society in a way too. It's what happened in our society as people tried to become more modern in how they lived and how they approached things in life. And it all kind of happened and grew together at the same time. But we've finally reawakened now and are realizing that maybe we haven't been well served by this direction that dying and death have taken when we do put them in the hands of other people instead of our own loved ones.
That's exactly right, yes. And I love so much what you do, Karen, in your work, revealing that within the medical industry and also embracing it as a great gift, and also offering alternatives now to find more, more involvement ourselves in the medical processes and in the funeral industry processes, the practices, that we can be more co-creative ourselves within those fields. And I think the result of that is what you're working on with End of Life University and what I'm working on with my work, you know, to just bring more humanity and more sacredness back to the way we are approaching medical issues and death and funeral industry issues. Yes,
and I know one of the initiatives that I've worked on a bit is encouraging people in the public to have advanced healthcare directives, but I noticed on your website that you encourage people to also have an advanced after death care directive. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, thank you. I'm very passionate about this, actually, mainly because I've worked as a licensed funeral director for 7 years and saw how deeply needed it is for people to have thought about after-death care choices and plans. So often we don't do that, and I certainly felt in the arrangement room in our little funeral home that, you know, it was the families of someone who had not thought about what they wanted at all or had a great deal more stress in making those choices themselves at a time of grief themselves, where they were grieving themselves. And I saw those families whose loved ones had thought about what they wanted after death and put it in place and even paid for it, that it allowed the ones left behind to just be more present with what they were feeling and with their grief.
And it's true, just as in before death care and after death care, when people have thought ahead, just understood their own wishes and preferences and then communicated them, it changes everything.
It really does, yes. And then especially when one wants something more alternative within our society, like home vigils and natural burial, it's even more important to think ahead and to plan and to imagine what ideal scenarios you would want for your end of life, and then to, you know, actively choose a disposition for your body after death that can actually happen. And because this movement, the Green Funeral Movement, is still pioneering and is not even well known within mainstream society, these advanced after death care directives, if made beforehand, actually help ensure a greater possibility of your plans and your wishes becoming a reality.
Sure, it makes sense that if people don't have these preferences in writing, we have this default mode. At least as I look at all of my older loved ones who have died in the past, it's been basically the same scenario. They've had the very same, being cared for in a funeral home, a visitation maybe the night before, and then a funeral in the funeral home, and then a burial the same day. It's all been, I would say, kind of formulaic. It's all been exactly the same process. And I think people resort to that if they have no idea what else is possible, and if they have no idea if their loved one might like something else.
That's exactly right, yes. And it's one reason I really wanted to write the book, Reimagining Death, so, you know, we can reimagine what is possible at the end of life and reimagine something that isn't the formulaic system that we just automatically turn to. And we do this in many ways collectively because we don't realize that we have these other choices. So, you know, the death care directive is really something that we as people in the Green Funeral Movement, in a sense, are making up. It's the next step on from an advanced health care directive. So the advanced health care directive, you know, gives an opportunity for you to put your wishes and plans into place for what you would want as you're dying. And so this other advanced after death care directive then takes it one step further, where you can create your wishes and plans for how you would want to be treated once you die, after your death. And it addresses this kind of forgotten time out of time, what I call a gap time, between the moment that you die and the time of your disposition, whether that be cremation or burial or natural burial or some of the new alternative ones. And that time out of time is a sacred time in many different cultures. And we in the Western world have forgotten it in a sense, mainly to do with the way people die. So many people die in hospitals and within our medical profession, as we've spoken about. And then we're just conditioned to immediately call a funeral director. And then that funeral director comes and takes the body away. And we think that's what we're supposed to do, as you said. But this re-looking at things and actually going back to the way we used to do things, where a body was kept at home for a time, just to give everyone more spaciousness and more opportunity just to be with the actual transition, with the sacredness of that transition. This is what we're reclaiming in the home funeral movement, supporting families to know that they have the legal and sacred right to ask for that time.
And so, Lucinda, if I wanted to create my own advance after death care directive, what kinds of questions should I answer as I make that?
Yes, that's a great question. Thank you. So I have, in my directive that I've created, I look at the threshold of death as three parts, three stages. So the first stage would be what I would call active dying in the Buddhist tradition, the bardo of dying. So I have some questions of, you know, what would you feel most comfortable? What is the scenario that would be most comfortable for you while you were dying? How can you imagine that? What kind of surroundings would help you feel most supported? And very importantly, what would make you feel most relaxed and at ease? Because in my trainings, I've trained in anthroposophy and also in Buddhist practices, and both those spiritual traditions really support the inquiry of what it means to cross the threshold. What does it mean for the transfer of consciousness to actually happen for our consciousness to leave the body? So if you are interested in that, you know, and want, and as we all want, the most peaceful death we can have, ideally, then what kind of scenario would support that? So that's one part of the advanced directive, even though that's not after death, that's the first stage of the threshold. The second being the moment of death and how we would best want that to happen. And then I focus mostly on the after-death choices and care, because that, in a sense, is still a pioneering inquiry in our look at death and dying issues and end-of-life issues. So I ask those questions. And then I ask, you know, would you like a home vigil after death? And if so, what would that look like for you? What would be your ideal scenario of that? And I help people actually imagine that and even have fun with it. You know, what would it look like? But most importantly, I ask, would you have a team of people, of family and friends, who would be willing to help make such a vigil happen? Because even though it is the most natural thing to keep someone at home, because it's not accepted in the mainstream so much, then all the infrastructure around the death isn't necessarily educated or aware of this possibility. So it requires a greater education and understanding of what it means to do a home vigil. And it really requires the family and friends to be willing to help.
Because I can imagine, you know, 120 years ago or so, it was a common thing to have home vigils and home funerals. And so probably neighbors would show up and other family members came and community members came to help when a death occurred in the family, because that's what people did. And everyone knew what their role was and what they were supposed to do.
That's right.
But we've lost all of that.
We have. We've lost all of it. So it's very important in the advance directive, or even just, you know, writing it down. It doesn't need to sound so formal as an advance directive, but just writing down in detail what you would want first, and then actually meeting with a team of the team that you've chosen, and helping them understand what it actually means. And so part of my consultation work is I often meet with families to help the families and the friends understand what they're signing on for, right? Mm-hmm. Because since none of us have really experienced this very much, it's hard for a team to say, yes, I'm in. I'll help you with that, because they don't even really know what that means. So all of the advance work is a proactive to educate and help people feel comfortable also with their choice to help a person who has chosen a home vigil.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next question would be, like, obviously, what would your disposition choice be for your body after death? And we're getting more and more choices in that, especially within the ecological movement. So, you know, our two mainstays are burial and cremation, but now we have the opportunity for witness cremation in some funeral homes. We have the opportunity for natural burial, and then we have what's called aquamation or alkaline hydrolysis, which is water cremation. There are many names for that. And then here in Seattle, we're going to be at some point offering recomposition, which is the composting of human bodies in urban areas. So again, especially the last two are new, and they're considered alternative. And so it's important for people to think about it ahead of time and really understand what these choices mean, and then share them with the people who are going to actually make it happen, which are your family and friends left behind.
And I would think, especially with the newer alternatives that people have never heard of and might feel uncomfortable with or nervous about until they're educated around that.
Yes, that's exactly right. So again, part of my consultation work is helping people understand what their choices actually mean, and what they, you know, would feel like, what they would feel like, and what they would look like, and all of those things are really important to consider as we were making our plans. And again, we're so used to either going to a funeral home, right, and doing pre-planning, and that pre-planning has a very formulaic choices that you make, and within that structure. And this is an entirely different thing, Karen. This is each of us having an opportunity to be ourselves, and to be more natural and more allowing ourselves to imagine and envision what we truly would like. And that is way more creative and more nourishing. It can be more creative and nourishing and even fun, you know. And I've done it with groups of people, these directives, and it can be a wonderful gathering, and it helps us deal with all of our fear and denial about death.
And I was going to ask you about that, because my own mother, my mom planned her own funeral. She planned the whole ceremony, everything she wanted, music and reading.
Yes, how wonderful.
And I noticed a clear change in her as soon as she did that planning. And she planned it about 5 years before she actually died. But suddenly she had so much more ease. It was so much more relaxed when we would talk about death together. And I really saw it helped her a great deal to have just gone through that thought process and to actually have envisioned it and to come away from it thinking, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. And having faced it, it changed everything for her.
Yes, that's a wonderful story. I encountered that as well, that if we do this work, and it is work, it's a, you know, it takes a lot to turn toward the probability or the, not the probability, the reality of one's death, and to imagine it, it requires deep consciousness. And I think one is changed by doing that, like you said your mother was. I think we can, once we accomplish that, we can turn back toward our lives in a much more whole way, because we've included or embraced our own mortality in our wholeness. We're more whole, really. Mm-hmm. I've experienced that myself and watching people do this kind of planning. And also, there's such a relief that it's all handled, you know, especially for our parents, that it's all handled and they're not going to be as much of a burden on us as well. So there's an ease in that as well, which I think is so valuable and so important.
And that was definitely important to my mom. You know, she definitely wanted to take away burden for my brother and I. But you're right, it was really helpful for me, because here for 5 years before she died, I had also heard from her advanced health care directive, so I knew that she wanted to die at home, she wanted me to care for her, and I knew what she wanted after death. And so for all those years, I was carrying that vision with me as well, which actually made it much easier for me to respond and to help make sure it happened when the time came, because I'd been kind of envisioning it myself and carrying that intention around that it's going to be my job one day to make sure this comes to reality. And so it was very helpful. Nothing was a surprise to me. I had been planning it for a long time and been preparing myself to play that role.
Yes, that's right. And I love the idea that you were carrying it with her, you know, that together you were carrying it. I mean, that must have made her feel so much better as well, just on an energetic level. And then, indeed, you were more prepared, which means, like I was saying when I shared about sitting in arrangement, you know, conferences with families at the funeral home, it's just so obvious that those who are prepared are less stressed. You know, they're less stressed. They're not trying to make these very crucial decisions at the last minute and at a time when the death has happened. And even if it's a anticipated death, the death is still so challenging to handle. And if you don't have to be making all these decisions at the same time that you're grieving, then things flow more easily, and that creates this ease, a greater opportunity for this ease and relaxation that I was talking about earlier to happen naturally and to support us, to deeply support the person dying and also the ones who are caring for them and the ones left behind.
Oh, it's just so true. When we're prepared, we have the ability to be more present, like you said, because we're not being constantly distracted by having to make decisions that we've never thought about before. That it comes much more naturally, and then we can really be fully present during that experience and during that sacred space that you described.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And you know, one gift of home vigils, well, we'll talk about that later, I know, but one gift is that it also gives an opportunity for the person dying to have a greater ease as well. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. my brother and I both felt really grateful at the end of my mom's life that we both already knew she wanted to be at home. And so when we had to make a decision about whether she should have a surgery or go back home, we already knew what to do. And it took away the burden and the pain of that decision because mom had made it very clear what she wanted.
Yes, yes. And then, so part of the directive is also then thinking about how to share those plans and wishes with your partner and with your children. Some families that I've worked with, you know, the parents who are often my age want these more alternative things, or simply want more participation from the family at the time of death, and yet they're not so sure that their children are that eager to help. Mm-hmm. So part of this, you know, thinking and planning together is really being able to speak to your adult children and say, look, this is what I really want, and, you know, it might seem weird to you, but this is, I would like this more alternative way of doing things. How do you feel about it? Will you be able to help? If not, and you don't want to do it, will you, be fine with someone else helping me? You know, these kinds of questions are important to look at beforehand. So that's part of the directive for me.
That's really good to think about, because I've had some friends tell me they've tried to talk with their adult children about what they want at the end of life and after death, and that their children don't want any part of it, and even say, oh, that's far off in the future. We don't need to talk about that now. And I was wondering if you have tips about how do we get our children to listen to us?
Yes, well, you know, it depends so much on who the family is and the relationship that the parents have with the children. And so I do it on an individual basis, but I think I've gleaned some tips, which one is to not be afraid ourselves to have these hard conversations, you know, to just say, you know, I'm thinking about this and it's very important to me and you're very important to me and we really need to sit down and how can I help you be more comfortable with the fact that we really need to have this gathering and this family discussion? I mean, one thing that I've been doing is offering, holding space and facilitating those kinds of consultations, because it is difficult for some parents to be able to say what I just said, you know, and to actually make that happen. And it's very difficult to keep asking that when our children just say, look, I don't want to talk about it. That's like you say, that's too far away. I'm not going to do it. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Again, it's really education. It's education for our children that it could happen at any moment. You know, it's again, being able to know that death could happen at any moment and that when one needs to be prepared and being able to have these hard conversations. Yeah.
I was thinking your book could be really helpful because it contains so many stories of really beautiful home vigils and green burials that someone could repeat to their, just say, I just read this amazing story about this and how this happened for this person and it was so beautiful and I would love to have that myself someday. You know, I could see that stories could help, or films, like if families were to watch films together, like A Will for the Woods, there are others I know that I can't think of the names right now, but I wanted to put a plug in for your book that it's a really helpful guide for people to get informed about what's possible and what can happen.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. That is one reason I wrote it. So thank you for underlining that. Because, you know, if a parent feels they can't really have this kind of meeting with their children, they can ask them if they might want to read the book. And I wanted to, you know, tell the stories in a way that was engaging for anyone of any age.
I wanted to mention that it has beautiful color photos so that people don't have to try to imagine what would that look like. But the photos are just incredible of vigils and funerals and burials that have taken place. And so that's something I just wanted to commend about your book as well.
Yes, thank you. I actually told North Atlantic, my publisher, that we had to have color photos, not just photos, mm-hmm. but color photos, that because those such photos, you know, they speak a thousand words and you can experience them by looking at them. So I was so fortunate that North Atlantic said yes to that, because it does, you know, help in this, in our age of visual everything as well, to be able to look at those photographs. So, yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did mention some of the many options available now for disposition. And I was just curious about, in terms of green burial, I mean, I always used to think that cremation was green burial, and I have subsequently been more educated and learned that it's not, and that cremation is not the most green form of disposition. So I didn't know if you wanted to share a little bit about that. When people really do care about the environment, what are some of the best choices they could consider for disposition?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, all of us, you know, thought that we were being ecological. In fact, so many people still think that by choosing cremation. So we're not taking up land for burial, and we're not filling the earth with, you know, concrete vaults and embalming fluid and steel caskets, and that whole conventional way of burial certainly is not ecological. But unfortunately, we're discovering that cremation is also not sustainable. It's not an ecologically sustainable choice for our future. And that's because to heat for the cremation, it uses enough gas and oil to drive your car 800 miles, something like that. Mm. And the mercury from our teeth, it goes into the environment, so the quality of air is endangered if we have the more and more cremations we have. And really the greatest one is the CO2 that is being emitted into the atmosphere. So it's a major cause of, it's certainly a major cause of climate change. And so we cannot continue to depend on cremation as a disposition choice for the future if we care about climate change and what's happening to our atmosphere. And so we need to think about things that are more ecological and that don't take as many resources. So aquamation, which is water cremation, that is a new offering. It's only available in 18 states right now. It's available in more states for pets, but for human beings, it's just 18. Washington State just passed it the week my book came out, which was a wonderful synchronicity. And that uses water and only enough fuel to heat the water, uses water and potassium sorbate, which is a lye, to dissolve the body. And then the body, the remains, some goes down in the waste system, the sewage waste system, and then the bones and things are remain and are ground up as much as cremains would be. So you receive back just as much as you do in cremains for fire cremation. Mm. And you receive those in an urn as well. But the difference is that those remains are very nutritional, and cremains are not. They're basically sterile. If you go through a fire cremation, then what remains is sterile. And some people are finding also that it's not even that nourishing for the earth to scatter ashes, even though we have thought for, you know, many years that it's okay. It's not that it's not okay. It's just that if people put ashes, many ashes, in a certain area, then it wouldn't not help that place, that land, and the ecology of that place. So, and then recomposition is a new amazing vision from a wonderful woman, Katrina Spade, who's a permaculturist and an architect. And her vision is to create a way for human bodies to be composted, and then that compost could be used to nurture and fertilize green spaces in urban places, or families can bring that compost home and use it in their own gardens and land. And you get actually a cubic foot of compost back in the recompose system. So these are all ways that actually give back to the earth. And then green burial itself, natural burial, certainly is a way that gives back to the environment if you choose that way. And that's because you literally are digging a grave, and you're putting the body into the grave without concrete vaults, without steel galvanized hermetically sealed metal caskets and endangered wood caskets, and without embalming, because embalming is very toxic. It's formaldehyde, and those chemicals are very toxic. So removing those elements, which are conventional burial, and just returning to giving the body back to the earth in a completely biodegradable and natural way, that actually gives back to the earth and can nourish the trees and the roots and shrubs and things that are around a green burial.
Thank you for that explanation of those alternatives that are somewhat new to us. And I'm just curious, I don't know, Lucinda, what method of disposition do you think you would prefer for yourself? Have you made a choice?
Yes, I have made a choice. I've chosen natural burial because here on my island, we have made our little old historical cemetery, what's called hybrid green. So it's a cemetery, but we've designated a whole area for green burial. And so I've bought a plot there. But, you know, after writing this book and researching these newer methods, I'm reconsidering, and I think that because even with green burial, we are buying plots, right? We have deeds, and we are buying a little piece of land, and we somehow think that that's going to be there forever. And we're in a time where land is becoming more and more scarce, and where just even the idea that there will be enough room for all of us to buy natural burial plots and to have them, it's just not a realistic or sustainable consideration. And, you know, in America, we're so used to having such space and so much land and so much open wilderness, and we're very spoiled in a way, Canada and America, that we think that this is going to just be available to us forever, and it's not. I mean, in Europe, the lack of land has been there forever, and, you know, there's things like successive burial where a family will buy a plot, and then another family member 50 years later will be buried in the same plot, or a body will actually be removed, and you can put another person in, and some plots are even rented, you know, or leased for a certain time. All of those things have been in place for years in places where land is scarce, and it's very true with overpopulation and with changing things in our public lands and an endangerment to our wilderness that we're not going to be able to even sustain natural burial. It's possible unless we do conservation burial. So I chose my little hybrid green cemetery, but I think now I would want a conservation burial, which in creating conservation burial grounds, you are saving land that would otherwise be developed, and because you create a conservation easement, and you're actually nourishing the ecology and the environment of that place and that piece of land. And that, to me, is a more sustainable choice for the future. And it's a win-win because we're preserving wilderness and land, and we're also creating nature preserves and places where families can visit the place where a loved one is buried. So either conservation burial or recompose. is my choice.
That's interesting because, as I said, in the past I used to assume that I would just be cremated, and having to rethink that choice, I'm glad to hear about aquamation, because I had this vision of having my ashes scattered, you know, around the world in various places. So it sounds like that's still possible with aquamation.
It is still possible, yes. And then, and you also know that those ashes that are scattered are nutritional to the places where they are placed.
Wow, so very interesting. That's just—it's just helpful information, and it's really important for all of us to think these things through. And maybe we think we know what we want at one point, but the more we get educated, we might all change our minds as time goes on. But we have to start somewhere. Yes. We have to start learning about what's out there, and then who knows what else might be on the horizon, other new possibilities in the future, too.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I mean, I never thought that recompose would be, you know, an actual viable possibility. I mean, I even have to now change what I've written in my book in that chapter, even though it just came out January 8th, because the recompose was legalized in Washington the week my book came out, and now I have to rewrite that whole section.
Oh.
so it's a, you know, it's an emerging field of inquiry and wonderful creativity and vision, and it's very exciting, actually, to be part of something that is working. You know, in our deaths, we're remaining environmentally aware and conscious. So it doesn't make sense to be environmentally aware and conscious all our lives, and then in our choices after death, we are not doing that. So these are ways to keep going with that environmental care. Yeah.
And Lucinda, what would you say are the biggest obstacles right now facing this, the home funeral and green burial movement? Like what's out there that kind of threatens the movement or makes it more challenging?
Yeah, so I'll start with green burial. Shar and I, at a sacred moment, you know, we were offering green burial as a central vision, and yet there are not that many places in the Seattle area where a family can actually have a green burial. And that's because the funeral industry has, and the cemetery businesses have basically bought up a lot of cemeteries, and they've instigated these policies. They're not laws, but they're policies that require concrete vaults, and they require, they, you know, prefer that the body's been embalmed, and all these aspects of conventional burial. When a family goes to choose a green burial plot, they actually can't find one. Or this is happening in states everywhere where natural burial is becoming more and more popular, and yet the places where you can actually have a natural burial are not, there are not enough of them to fulfill the interest and need. So that's one great challenge. And I'm becoming more involved in the natural burial and conservation burial movement in order to help facilitate more areas being opened to meet the interest and need of baby boomers, particularly, who are making this choice. The other one is more complicated around just what is green, you know, and if you buy a biodegradable bamboo casket and you're shipping it all the way from England or from Indonesia, is that really a green choice, right? Mm-hmm. So there's many levels of what it means to choose an ecological green burial and how green that actually is. So that's a challenge. In the home funeral world, again, it's we're pioneering this. I mean, even though it's something we did all of us 100 years ago, it's now considered a pioneering effort. And so in the mainstream, there's still a great challenge to educate the infrastructure around a death. So to educate funeral directors that it's actually legal in all 50 states for families to care for their own dead, although there are 9 states where a funeral director the laws have changed in those states where the funeral director has to be involved. But legally, in all 50 states, families can care for their own dead. But no one knows this, including funeral directors and including medical examiners and even hospice workers who are a natural, you know, precursor to a home vigil. We've had to do a lot of education for hospice and for medical workers for them to know that it's possible for families to bring someone home from the hospital or to keep someone at home for up to 3 days legally, as long as a body is refrigerated within 24 hours. So there are still challenges and obstacles for home funerals to happen, but it's becoming more and more possible as people are educated and as the awareness grows that it's really a very doable thing and families can do this.
So I wanted to mention that the National Home Funeral Alliance is a good resource if people are looking for information even about the state they live in and finding out what the laws are or regulations where they live if they're interested. So it seems like that's still something everyone needs to do is do their homework and do research while they're making these plans.
Yes, by all means. I mean, in my book, I just refer to National Home Funeral Alliance over and over because it's just such a wonderful resource for families to, just to learn every aspect of what it means to choose a home vigil and even find home funeral guides near them and what's available legally, you're right, and what is not legal in each state in terms of transporting the body and all kinds of things. And it's a wonderful resource to give to, one's doctor and hospice workers and medical examiners also, so that they can feel more reassured themselves that they're not doing something that's not legal, different people in their positions, are worried about their jobs and whether they're doing it right. And I just learned of a story of a young family whose little boy, 4 years old, died in a hospital, and they just so wanted to bring the little boy home. And legally, they could have done that, but nobody in the hospital, the doctors, the nurses, the social worker, no one knew that that was actually a possibility. And so they couldn't support it because they were afraid to release the little boy's body to the family. So again, it's education, and the National Home Funeral Alliance is just leading the way in that education.
And that website, it's funeralalliance.org, is that correct?
I think it's Home Funeral,
Home Funeral
Alliance.
Yes. HomeFuneralAlliance.org. Okay.
Yes.
If anyone's interested. And
yes.
Then I wanted to just remind everyone listening that I'm talking with Lucinda Herring, who's just one of the pioneers in the home funeral and green burial movement. And we have been talking partly about her new book that just came out, Reimagining Death, Stories and Practical Wisdom for Home Funerals and Green Burials. So Lucinda, where can people get a hold of your book?
I'm selling my books on my website, which is www.lucindaherring.com. And that's a possibility. It's also available through Amazon. It's available through any independent bookstore. Penguin Random House is the distributor, which is a wonderful gift. So it's really present in most bookstores, Barnes & Nobles, anywhere where you would, find good books to read, you'll probably find my book, which is a great celebration.
Yes, and I'll just endorse it again. It's a beautiful book, and it's not just a book for home funeral guides as a resource for them. It's really a book for anyone who's interested and thinks, you know, this is what I would like for myself and my loved ones. And you can use this book as a way of getting educated, but also inspired by reading these beautiful stories and seeing the pictures of what other people, the choices other people have made, and how lovely this end of life experience and after death experience has been for the families.
Yes, thank you. I'm greatly passionate about helping anyone find more creative and healing and nourishing ways to handle death, you know, either if that's one's own or certainly the death of those we love. And these ways of doing this and these more natural ways, which are our instinct, our natural instincts are to do this for each other and for ourselves. My book, I hope that it can support and empower anyone who might be interested in this to look further and to reimagine what is possible for them.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, Lucinda, you are such a treasure. You have so much knowledge and wisdom from just from this work that you've been doing for such a long time. And I thank you so much for really leading the way. And I'm sure through a lot of years when there weren't very many people who were listening. And I'm excited that your book is out in the world and that it's doing really well. And I think we're on the threshold of big changes. And I just want to thank you for helping us get to this place.
You're so very welcome. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak about it. And yes, it's been a long journey, and there are many exciting things emerging from this. And I'm just so excited about how many people are interested now, you know, the whole death positive movement, the younger generation. It's a different level, and it's happening now, and that's a celebration. So thank you, Karen, so much.
Absolutely. Well, Lucinda, I'm so glad we got to have our first conversation, and I'm looking forward to many more in the future.
Yes, me too.
All right. Thanks again, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Lucinda Herring, and that you will get out there and get a copy of her book, Reimagining Death. Lucinda did write back to me after the interview with a couple of things she had wanted to add that got left out during our conversation. And so one of those was the suggestion, if you're interested in cremation, one way to make fire cremation more eco-friendly is to find a crematorium that offers a carbon offset program. For example, they might plant a tree or a certain number of trees for every cremation they do. So that was one of her suggestions. And then also she had wanted to talk about the benefits of a home funeral for family and friends and for the person who has died. So I'm going to read these to you, these benefits that Lucinda sent to me. So first of all, family and friends can grieve their loss together in a private, non-institutionalized setting when a funeral is held at home and a vigil is held in the home. She says a family-directed funeral promotes healing and closure by providing a safe, loving container where emotions can be expressed and held and where death's mysteries can be explored with others. She also says a vigil can last as long as the family wishes, from a few hours up to 3 days, which allows those grieving more time to come to terms with the death, find a sense of closure, and create personal and meaningful rituals of farewell with others. Next, she mentions that freedom of spiritual expression is available in a home funeral vigil, which is a really important point. She said whether it's a Christian family singing Amazing Grace over their mother's body, or a Buddhist community chanting prayers to accompany their friend's consciousness after death, vigils provide the space and time to create exactly what the departed person and those left behind really need. Next, she mentions that home funeral vigils create an environment where children can experience death as a natural part of life. And I think that's a really important comment to make. I think a home funeral would be much more inviting and comfortable for children than being in a funeral home that might feel very foreign and sterile and threatening as an environment. Also, she mentioned that home funeral vigils encourage active, creative, and healing expression, such as building or decorating the casket or creating special rituals of remembrance. Another very good point. Home funeral vigils use dry ice and refrigeration to preserve the body instead of embalming. So that's just a practical solution, particularly when we have concerns about our environment and putting those chemicals back into the earth. And then home funeral vigils can be more cost effective than conventional funeral options also, and can be shaped to fit a family's lifestyle and budget. So those are some great benefits of a home funeral for family and friends. And then she added that a home funeral also benefits the person who has died. She wrote that many spiritual traditions, both Western and Eastern in origin, feel that a person's soul or consciousness may need more time at the threshold of death in order to depart from the body in the best possible way. So home vigils provide that extra time and space for the person who has died to make the transition in whatever way is needed. Also, that vigils provide a natural container for prayers and spiritual practices to be offered around the body, which might be important to the deceased person. And then beliefs that a person's consciousness remains nearby, at least for the first few days, means that a home vigil can be a comforting and supportive transition for that person. So thanks, Lucinda, for sending me those extra comments. I think that will be really helpful for people who heard our interview. And remember that you can pick up Lucinda's book, Reimagining Death, at bookstores anywhere. And I believe the book has already been quite successful this year since it's been released. And I think it would be a really helpful guidebook for everyone to have on hand. So as always, thanks for tuning in and joining me on the podcast. I'm so happy to have an audience of you out there who listen in every week. Next Monday, there will be a new episode, and it will be another part of the series, the Mortal Wisdom series, so you can stay tuned to hear what's coming up next in that series next Monday. And until then, remember that we are here for love. So be sure to face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings your way. And love each and every moment of your life while you have it. See you next time. Bye-bye.